There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome back to the second hour of the show. It's just after 4 o'clock. Let's put in the picture of what's been going on in the world of sport. We've got a result from the Rugby Championship. A couple of results, in fact, CVR.
Yeah, Tom, what I can tell you is that South Africa have lost to Australia 23 points to 18. The Australians have beaten South Africa in the Rugby Championship. So once again, big questions getting asked about Rassie Erasmus, his team selections, and of course his coaching staff. Earlier this morning, the All Blacks beat Argentina 46 points to 24. Once again, a comprehensive victory by the All Blacks. And the big question on everybody's tongues at the moment is, can anybody beat the All Blacks? I don't believe so. Coming up this afternoon in the Pro 14, we've got kicking off at 6 o'clock, we've got Newport Dragons taking on the Southern Kings. In the top 14, Bordeaux Bogles take on Montpellier. That game kicks off at 4:45. In the Currie Cup, Griquas take on the Lions. That game kicks off at just after 4 o'clock here in Dubai. And in the Gallagher Premiership, should I rather say, Wasps take on Exeter Chiefs. That game kicks off at 5 o'clock this afternoon.
Hey, listening to The Grill, we're all things sport on a Saturday afternoon. The cricketers are in for a little bit of lunch at the moment. It's lunch between England and India. What's the latest, Mark Archer?
Yeah, 300 for 8, so it's been a good morning for England. They were struggling along, 7 down. The only wicket to fall in the first session was Adil Rashid, LBW to Bumrah for 15. That's been an unbroken partnership of 86 runs between Jos Buttler, 62 not out, and Stuart Broad, 34 not out. So England will be far the happier with the first session of day two at the Oval. 300 for 8. They'll be happy that they've recovered in posting a decent first innings total, Tom.
Yeah, that was unlikely, wasn't it, first thing this morning? What, they were 190-odd or something like that for 7 going out. So just lose that solitary a wicket, but also to extend the lead by 100 runs from their overnight position. Good early session.
It's been England's strength, hasn't it? The middle and lower order batting in this series. If it's not been someone like Jos Buttler chipping in or Johnny Bairstow getting some runs, it's been Sam Curran who've just found the runs. When it looks as though India have got on top in some of these matches, and then it's just those late wicket stands to England that have really got them in the match and been competitive. So England 300 for 8. It's lunchtime on the day 2 of the 5th and final test match of the Oval. England, of course, have won the series 3-1, but plenty to play for. Plenty of players trying to impress selectors to say, yes, I do have a future in international cricket.
Let's just stick with that one, because obviously there is one big story that's dominated that one. That's Alistair Cook. We can't deny the figures. England's leading test run scorer of all time, etc. A quality player during his right. Just to play devil's advocate, though, for a moment. I mean, should he be playing in this game?
Why? Because he's announced his retirement?
Yeah.
I think he should. I think he's earned the right to make his retirement statement whenever he's chosen. And I think the best that England cricket can do is give him the opportunity to send him off the right way. And he's still the best opening batsman in England, so they have to pick him. I mean, who else? They've been struggling to find a replacement partner for Andrew Strauss for almost 6 or 7 years now. And Alistair Cook has been the one constant element there in that England opening batsman side. They've tried numerous batsmen. None have seemed to have been stuck with Tom, and none have really held down a position. So Alistair Cook, yeah, if he wasn't retiring, you've got to pick him. And if he is retiring now, you still pick him for this final test match. I think he's earned the right to play this final test match at the Oval, without a doubt.
A rock at the top of the England order for, what, the last 12 years or so. CVR, his first name on the list in more ways than one as that England opener. Are we seeing, is it not just the end of his career, we're seeing the end of an era? I mean, do you think we'll see his like again? And what I mean by that is, obviously, he's a very traditional test batsman, which we don't really see the ilk of these days with the advent of T20 and one-day cricket.
Yeah, I think cricket's changing a lot, Tom. And to your point, will we see something like that again? I don't think so. You know, I think cricket is now becoming a game where you become a specialist kind of in your, either it's T20 or one-day or five-day. And I must say, Alistair Cook, you know, he seemed to fit that role. But to me, the big issue is, if I was the coach, I don't think I would have allowed him to retire. I know that you can't really call this, because I think England need him at the moment. I don't think it's a very good time for him to say goodbye, because I think he's left a massive gap there. And to me, there's nobody really suitable to replace him that can kind of step into his shoes. So I kind of think, from a ECB perspective, maybe they haven't really looked into this as well as what they should have, because you would think that they had somebody, you know, in the making, you know, kind of bring him into the fray. But at this moment in time, I don't really see there is anybody that can take over from Alistair, because he has done such a superb job for England.
Has he done Keaton Jennings a favour? Because Jennings has had a woeful series against India. There's been all sorts of question marks around whether he is cut out for Test cricket. But the fact that we're now looking for not one opener but two openers, does that sort of give Keaton Jennings a stay of execution?
I guess it makes it a little bit easier to try and pick Keaton Jennings, because he's the man in position at the moment, and it'll be hard to find two new openers to go to Sri Lanka. And England need two new openers in Test cricket for next year when the Ashes come around, when Australia tour. So I guess it's going to give him a bit more of a breathing space in terms of keeping his opening batting position. But he hasn't quite convinced yet. He hasn't quite shown me enough that he's good enough to be there on a long-term basis. But he looks as though he can score runs and count in championship cricket, but he doesn't look as though he's really got the ability. Because again, you would think on paper, Indian seam bowling attack is one of the attacks you'd like to play against in your own conditions at home in England. It's not going to blow you away. It's not going to blast you off the park. You know, they've done some great job bowling, you know, some good line and length and got the ball nipping around a bit, but it's English conditions. So you would have thought that they'd fancy the chances about trying to get some decent starts away. He just hasn't convinced. He hasn't got any notable scores. He's got in. He's done a bit of a job seeing off the new ball, but then he hasn't cashed in. So England need opening batsmen who can really bat. Test matches are still 5 days. You've still got to bat for long periods of time. You've got to see off the new ball, and then you've got to capitalise. And Keaton Jennings hasn't quite convinced yet in a way that, say, an Alistair Cook does when he's playing well.
Surely there's got to be a couple of South Africans or Kolpak players that we can call on.
Yeah, well. I'm sure you'll be dialing 911 South Africa and pick up a player like you guys normally do. But to me, Tom, also interesting, Arch, and I'd like to get your opinion on it. Surely with Alistair Cook no longer in that batting line, it puts a lot more pressure on Joe Root as a captain and as a batsman.
Yeah, and they had the whole issue with Joe Root batting three, and then in the last test match between innings, he said, no, I want to bat number four. So there's obviously indecision there about where Joe Root obviously wants to bat
should
four.
Should be batting four.
Should be batting four, but with England's strength in the middle order, when you've got Butler, Bairstow, Stokes, Curran, it's who's going to bat three. You can't pick a team full of middle order batsmen. And again, test match cricket, still about 5 days, you've still got a red ball, you've got to do a job at the top of the order to protect those guys in the middle order, give them a platform. You want to be 100 for one after, you know, 35 overs, and give those guys a chance to come in, not 20 for two and into the best batsmen already. So England do have some question marks, and I'm not sure where they're going to go to, because there doesn't seem to be any young up-and-coming guys in the early 20s. There seems to be a lot of veteran sort of guys in the county circuit who are 29, 28, 30, who they may come back to again to give a chance. And then they've been reluctant to do that in the series and give guys, bring them from county cricket. So Alistair Cook will be massive gap at the top of the English order, and it's a shame. I think one of the genuine nice guys in world cricket, a good bloke off the field, pretty down to earth. And I think the England team will miss his rock-like temperament and his sort of ability to probably keep things pretty real in the day of rock and roll cricket that we have now these days.
One international wicket, I think he's got, isn't it?
He's got one. Yeah, I was watching some highlights on Twitter yesterday, and it said give Alistair Cook a bowl. There's Chef Bowl. You know, there was a Twitter handle going around, but he's got at least one. He bowls some pretty ugly medium pace, I think.
We'll do a little delving into that one, work out who his international scalp is for you. Let's just take a moment, if we can, to reflect on the illustrious career of Alistair Cook.
It's a huge testament to his determination, his drive.
His hunger for runs is something that we all admire.
It doesn't just prove the calibre of the player, but what a calibre of the person as well.
I'm very privileged to have played on the same side as him for 9 years.
So his first test match, so I'm getting 100 in Nagpur. He always came across as a mentally really tough bloke.
He missed just one test at the end of that tour and has been ever present ever since.
I came over as a 15-year-old and I remember playing against him. I don't remember him well, but I remember the name well. I didn't realise then that he would go on to such heights. And I think since his debut in India, where he made 100, I think we knew there was someone special.
He had quite a weird technique too, so to be honest with you, I never quite felt like I could get him out in a specific kind of way.
It's a terrific record, 30 test match hundreds for him, one more than Sir Donald Bradman. which speaks volumes of his quality as a player.
People don't always know the man behind. He keeps himself to himself, not a big man on social media or anything like that, but would have time for everybody.
England hadn't won the Ashes in Australia since 86-87. And when they headed there for the 10-11 series, they had Alistair Cook at the peak of his powers. England went back after a 3-1 victory with the Ashes in hand.
Clearly the KP affair was a tough year, there's absolutely no doubt about that.
You're not allowed to voice opinions against the regime, especially against the leader of the regime. You're not allowed to. There will be a time when revenge is a dish best served cold.
As a players, we're just desperate now to, you know, there's nothing more of that can really come out, and we can just go and try and build and move forward as a side, and that, as a captain, that is a good place to be.
I think the main question of course is still, does Alistair Cook earn a place in the side, let alone captain it?
I'm still here, and I still want to be, as I said at the beginning of the week, to throw it all in to be captain of England.
It's a tough gig to keep them to go against the best bowlers and the new ball at the top of the order.
I don't think he earns a place in the side as a batsman, and therefore shouldn't be in the side.
If you take him out of the equation, then you've got to find someone else, and we haven't yet worked out who might replace him.
You're a fool to write off Alistair Cook.
You can never, ever write off a champion player, and Alistair Cook has been a champion for England for a long period of time.
Cookie's done some fantastic things for England, not just in his career, but in the recent past as well.
But it is obviously a very special moment for me personally. You know, to join the club and the kind of the company that people have scored 10,000 runs in. Yeah, it certainly means a lot.
Speaking to the media at Lord's today, Cook admitted he cannot do this job at 95%, and therefore it was time to hand over to someone else.
Yeah, ultimately, I know it's the right decision for myself and for the team. It doesn't make it any easier, and it is time to move on.
It is still an immense shock to the system to know finally that Alistair Cook's career is about to come to an end. He will bow out of Test cricket at the Oval.
Well, he's been one of England's greatest cricketers.
I've never been the most talented cricketer. I definitely think I got everything out of my ability. A couple of beers in, which I needed to be, otherwise I would have cried more than I actually did. I managed to hold it together.
I miss him being around, not just for his runs and what he adds to the team, but for him as a person as well. And I hope he thoroughly enjoys the next chapter in his life.
This is The Grill. Get involved with Dubai Eye on Facebook.
Game on indeed. You are listening to The Grill. We're live from Brasti where the game is always on. We've got England against India. They're at lunch at the moment. England sitting pretty on, how much was it, Arch? Just broken 300, isn't it?
304 for 8 at lunch. So England are in a good position. They fought back well. They were about 200 for 7. It's an unbroken partnership between Stuart Broad and Joss Butler of 90 runs. So they've done really well there. They're really happy with that recovery. Joss Butler, 63 not out. Stuart Broad, 36 not out. The tail is wagging for England. 304 for 8 at lunch on day 2 of the fifth and final test match.
Let's go down under now if we can, because obviously plenty of action taking place in AFL and NRL. Mark Archer, what's the latest?
Yeah, let me bring you up to date, Tom, because it's finals footy down under in the next couple of weeks. It's the playoff season in both the NRL and the AFL. Let's start with the Australian rules code, because it's at the right into the playoff stretch here. Two matches yesterday, two matches today. There is one live match ongoing, and it's the West Coast. This is over in Perth. It's the West Coast Eagles taking on Collingwood Magpies, and it's the Magpies who currently lead in the fourth quarter of this match, 63 points to 59. So it's the Magpies leading the Eagles 63 points to 59 in the final quarter. Result from earlier today, it was the Sydney Derby. It was the GWS Giants. They hammered their rivals, the Swans, 79 points to 30 at the Sydney Cricket Ground. They advance in the playoff stakes. Couple of big results over the last couple of days, Tom. The Richmond Tigers, they won the qualifying final with a big 31-point victory against Hawthorn at the MCG in front of 91,000 spectators. The Tigers won that match against Hawthorn, 95 to 64. Melbourne also, they marked their return to finals footy with a gritty 29-point victory in the elimination final against the Geelong Cats, 75 points to 46. So wins there for Richmond Tigers, Melbourne, the GWS Giants, And then Collingwood are leading by 4 points in the final quarter. NRL action, there's been plenty of big matches this weekend as well. Earlier today, we've seen the Penrith Panthers eliminate the New Zealand Warriors 27 points to 12. We've seen the Sydney Roosters get past the Cronulla Sharks 21 points to 12 in that match. And then we've also seen a thriller yesterday between the Melbourne Storm and the South Sydney Rabbitohs, with the Storm sneaking home by 1 point, 29 points to 28. Let's just have a listen to the final stages of that match, with the Storm clinching a 1 point victory.
And there's a penalty. Yeah, he was checked there for Nukan, and they might even look at whether this is a professional foul.
Yeah, Ash,
there's
a guy that comes across.
Do you have the name, G?
No. I was blocked.
George Burgess in the bin.
He's gone. Reynolds, can he put more pressure on here? A high kick. Rinivalu up. Oh! It's been taken by Inglis! Inglis has got over the line, but has he got the ball down?
He has eventually.
He's old mate Billy's there. It's Slater on Inglis.
Onside.
And the skipper looks like he's prevailed. He's trying to struggle to his feet. He got there in the end. Cook away. Reynolds now for Walker. They've got numbers. They're going to go over. It's Robert Jennings. He scored. A charging Tim Glasby, who's back out there. Smith, Munster, Stimson, Blair, yes! For Walker, for Murray, Cameron Murray is going to break through and score! Felice Kaufusi, for Cameron Smith, for Kenny Bromwich, for Cameron Munster, for Slater, look at that! Blair now, and O'Carr with pace, and the kick over the top, Blair's there! Melbourne have scored!
Brilliant.
They will not go away! Where's Cameron Smith? Well, he's a dummy half.
Cameron Munster wants
Munster's the man, left foot shot, Munster towards the post, Munster's kicked it! Cameron Munster, what a play!
That's the worst field goal you've ever seen, but it went over, right over the black dot. What a wonky one.
Two plays left for Souths. There's a hand in there. The ball's been turned over. Melbourne have got it. The refs are happy. The Storm are going to get the week off, and they're 80 minutes away from another grand final appearance.
That was the Melbourne Storm defeating the South Sydney Rabbitohs by 1 point, 29 to 28, thanks to that extra point, the drop goal, when time was up there. So a good win for the Melbourne Storm. They get next week off and they advance to the next stage of the final. So earlier today, also wins for the Penrith Panthers and the Sydney Roosters. Those teams will all advance in the playoffs. Just to go back and recap those AFL scores, wins to Richmond Tigers in the qualifying final against Hawthorn. Melbourne had a great victory against the Geelong Cats. The Cats are now eliminated. They'll prepare for their Mad Monday and go on holiday. Melbourne are through to take on Hawthorn next weekend. And then in the Sydney Derby, big win there for the GWS Giants. And currently, with a couple of minutes remaining, 5 minutes remaining in Perth at Optus Stadium, it's the West Coast Eagles 66 and the Collingwood Magpies 63. 8 minutes remaining in that match. Let's see who wins that victory between the Eagles and the Magpies.
Interesting chat you had midweek. I was listening in to your chat with Paddy Campos of the EAFL here in the region. New season kicks off here. Obviously, a new NFL season kicking off over stateside as well. That point you made, I found myself shouting at the radio as well.
Shouting at me?
Shouting at you.
It's a normal day, isn't it?
But is that... I wasn't conscious of the fact that sort of... American football has now taken over as the sport of the United States.
Oh, I think by it depends how you're measuring it. By any form of measurement, it's the biggest sport by a long way. They always talk about baseball as the summer sport, as the national game, to that degree. But the revenues generated by the NFL, the crowds that show up week in week out for the 32 teams. Nothing competes with it. Baseball season's 160 plus games in their regular season. It does go on a long time. Baseball for many get interesting when they get to the playoffs, but it's a short, compacted season. 16 matches in the regular season, they get into the playoffs. You know, it actually started. So the season got underway on Thursday night with the Philadelphia Eagles having a win last year's Super Bowl champion, Super Bowl 52, of course, against the Patriots. They had a win against the Atlanta Falcons. The final this year is in Atlanta at the Super Bowl 53. And yeah, by every measure that you can try and put on a sport in terms of how big and how significant, whether it be the financial revenues or the TV audiences or the crowds that show up across the season, NFL is number one in the US. Then you've got their other major sports. You've got the NBA season, of course. You've got Major League Baseball, and then you've got hockey probably in fourth position. Football's growing there, but it's still a long way behind those big four sports. Carlos, CVR, was in the home of Nike only a couple of weeks ago, and you attest to how big, not just the NFL is, but how big college football is almost bigger as well. But NFL dominates. College football is massive as well.
Yeah, I was at quite right. I was at the home of the Ducks, and as you say, these guys have got stadiums that we only dream of. And it's interesting for me in this last 2 weeks, Arch, especially in the NFL, some quarterbacks signing some very, very big contracts, and also Odell Beckham now, I think the highest paid wide end receiver in the history. So yeah, very, very big sport there, Tom. Followed religiously. And as you say, you know, it's very difficult for any other sport to compete with these American sports. Of course, big news this week that David Beckham, they've now launched the Miami franchise in Miami for the MLS, and it's going to be interesting to see how that goes, and if that can, through David and of course his connections and who he gets to play for his team, if that can grow the MLS a lot more in America. But I still think it's going to be very, very tough to compete with the big three sports that Arch just mentioned.
Yeah, just to wrap that score up, the first kickoff in the NFL was Thursday night. It was the Philadelphia Eagles defeating the Atlanta Falcons 18 points to 12 there. Of course, Tom, we all go through now to the playoffs in January. We have the Super Bowl 53 to look forward to, on February the 3rd, and it's all underway. But 32 NFL teams. Then you look at Division 1 of the NCAA, the colleges. There's 120 teams that compete week in, week out, that fill stadiums across the ground to a bigger level. There's stadiums there like Michigan, the big house in Michigan, 100,000 fans show up every week for a home match, and that big television audience, of course. College football is usually on a Saturday, and then all the NFL matches are primarily on a Sunday, so they've got the balance right there. But yeah, massive crowds. American football, NFL, does rule unprecedentedly in the US sports landscape.
I know there's that rule of thumb that sport and politics do not mix, but over in the United States they seem to be at the moment. Is it unfortunate that we've got this Nike issue that's sort of dominating the first weekend of the season? Were Nike misguided in using Colin Kaepernick for their latest advertising campaign?
Well, I guess I can't comment on
tough
that.
One for you to comment on.
I can't comment on that, but I think,
of course, he can comment. He works for them.
I think at the end of the day, you know, it's questionable. Was it the right thing to do? I don't know. As I said, I can't comment on it. But you know, Tom, if there's one thing that it has done, it's got people talking, and I think that was the main thing behind it. And as I say, very, very interesting. I don't personally like sport and politics mixing. I don't think there's any place for the two to be next to each other. But as I said, that's just my two cents worth.
Interesting though, isn't it? Because obviously, off the back of that, Donald Trump has chirped in as well. Is he criticising the organisation? Is he criticising the company? Or is he criticising the game at the moment as it is?
I think Donald Trump just criticises everyone, full stop, doesn't he? To not go too far away from the subject. For me, the subject that was actually... this has been moved around here, and it's what's actually been protested about has been taken by Trump and turned into something else, and then Nike have actually turned it into something else again. So originally this has happened about 2 years ago. Colin Kaepernick, star quarterback at the time for the San Francisco 49ers, went to a Super Bowl. He started kneeling at the start of matches, before the start of matches, when they had the national anthem. This was in protest to the treatment of black people in North America due to police brutality. That was generally what the protest was. That was why other players make a political statement. Okay, you can argue the merits of that, right or wrong. Should they be doing that in public or should they be not? We can discuss that. Donald Trump has then come out and criticized these plus respecting the anthem and America and disrespecting the military. For the military folk that go off and serve in wars and go off and fight for their country, he's saying that you're disrespecting the military. Now, to my knowledge, the guys that are making these protests, it's got nothing to do about the military whatsoever. They're trying to prove a point about a political situation in the US, as anyone's entitled to do. It's the land of the free and the home of the brave. You're allowed to make a point in the US. Now, Donald Trump's criticised the players. He's criticised the NFL for not making it compulsory, for setting a bad example. He said these players maybe should go and they should get banned. They should get banned from the game if they disrespect the anthem. So they've come up with, they've looked at policies of trying to do this. They said the players that want to protest the anthem just stay in the locker room while the anthem's again being played. There's that solution. And then Nike have kind of grabbed the situation again, as Nike like to do. They're all about selling sneakers and clothes, and they've made a point of it. and an advertising campaign, which is fine, because that's the way America works, that's the way the world works. So for me, the subject's just been moved around to highlight something slightly different every time, and it's not what the original point was. The protests by the black players, not just them, to kneel during the national anthem, is to say we're not happy with the policing situation, the violence against black North Americans, Afro-Americans, due to police brutality. That's what the whole protest is about. Trump's hijacked it and turned it into a whole political debate. So that's, for me, it just... And it's ongoing. It's an ongoing, unresolved situation. Colin Kaepernick has now been made...
Is he the loser in this as well? Because you mentioned there, you know, star quarterback several years ago, now doesn't have a team.
Can't be employed, yeah. He hasn't had a job for 2 years. So he effectively cancelled his contract with the 49ers. He was a star player. I mean, big name player, quarterback at the time. And he's taking the NFL to court. He feels that he's being, that the owners of the teams are colluding against him not to employ him because he brings too much negative attention due to this protest level. So he's obviously not good enough to be picked up by a team, but he's faced himself where his career's effectively ended now because of the situation, his protest, his political statement. At the same time, Nike continued to back him and endorse him, use him as an endorser, and obviously promote their products. So it's a tough situation, but look, you know, we've seen it before in other sports. Occasionally sport and politics do unfortunately mix.
4001, if you would like to share your thoughts and opinions with us. Let's take a short break, shall we? We haven't spoken football yet, so when we come back, we will turn our attention to the games that you've got to look forward to in the UEFA Nations.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
Game on, indeed. Talking of games, Northern Ireland take on Bosnia-Herzegovina in just a few moments' time. Around about 20 minutes or so, I should say, in their first game of the brand new UEFA Nations Cup Championship. Leeds United goalkeeper Bailey Peacock-Farrell starts in goal for Northern Ireland. The England goalkeeper recently pledged his future to Northern Ireland after being sounded out to switch allegiance to the Three Lions. Carl Lafferty, Stuart Dallas, Niall McGinn start in attack as Will Grigg, who is always on fire, has to make do with a place on the bench. So Peacock-Farrell, McLaughlin, Evans, Cathcart-Lewis, Norwood, Davis, Saville, McGinn, Lafferty and Dallas are the starting 11 for Northern Ireland. Former Man City striker Edin Dzeko starts and captains Bosnia-Herzegovina. Mo Besic, currently on loan at Middlesbrough from Everton, plays at right back for them. So Windsor Park is ready. Are we ready? What is the Nations Cup? I'm still trying to figure it out myself. Has anyone been able to explain it to you?
Art said he'll explain it to us.
No, I tried to explain it during Sports Tonight this week, and I was looking at different numbers of graphs, and I was looking at, I've seen it explained on television, and then I've read an explanation of it, Tom, and I'm still confused. But so I do know what I think the concept is. Let me explain it conceptually. Okay. I think UEFA are trying to create, because we have these international friendly breaks a few times a season. They become very frustrating because we're 3 weeks into a Premier League season, we're 2 weeks into La Liga, a couple of weeks into Bundesliga, and all of a sudden we stop for what most people think is a meaningless international friendly break. I think UEFA want to try and add some relevance, some credibility to what is essentially a friendly match between nations, and give them a chance to actually qualify, albeit a secondary qualification chance to get into the UEFA European Championships. So I think that's part of the rationale, is to give these matches some context and some relevance. But how that works, I'm confused. There's like four groups, and I don't know who beats who, and if you get promoted, and if you get relegated, and who you have to play against, and why you play against them.
Let's have a go. So the long and the short of it is that all 55 of UEFA's members take part in the competition. Now that goes from obviously the big guns like your Germany's, your France's, your Italy's, down to the Faroe Islands, Liechtenstein, and the smaller ranked teams in UEFA. They're split into four leagues. The best European teams up in League A, down to the lowest ranked European teams in League D. Those at the end of the season's tournament, some countries will be promoted and some will be relegated. Tournament is played every 2 years. The big reward, four places at the 2020 European Championships up for grabs. So the hope is that lower-ranked teams are more likely to qualify for the Euros, and that internationals themselves will get more fans. So, yeah, it goes on to what you were saying, that sort of credibility. but also the light at the end of the tunnel, the prize is the opportunity for lower ranked teams to get their make their way through to the European Championships.
But for me, does that mean that then the lower ranked teams, which probably take these friendlies more seriously than the big teams anyway, the likes of France and Germany and England and Spain, who like to give a few of these matches a few players a run out, these are the weekends where we see a lot of club players kind of go, I've got a bit of a dodgy hamstring, my back's a bit sore, I'll probably take the weekend off, which we do see regularly. Are they going to take it any more seriously than they would normally, because they'll qualify, you would have thought, through the normal process? So it's actually better for the smaller clubs. I'm still a bit baffled to it, but I kind of understand the concept. Whether it works or not, well, I guess the jury's out on that. We'll wait and see.
Northern Ireland take on Bosnia-Herzegovina this afternoon. 5 o'clock kickoff on that one. It's live down here at Barasti if you'd like to watch it. A little later on this evening, you've got England against Spain. That's a 10:45 kickoff over in the United Kingdom. Finland take on Hungary. Belarus are at home to San Marino. Switzerland take on Iceland. Estonia against Greece. And Luxembourg against Moldova. Those are the games to look forward to this evening. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, it certainly seems like yesterday that we saw the culmination of the World Cup and then back out again.
Well, I was in Moscow a couple of weeks ago watching the final, and now we've got all these teams playing again. It's just a bit, it's a bit weird. It's tough to get into. It was quite hard for me even to get too excited about the start of the Premier League season, Tom. You like that bit of break during the summer. We like to focus on cricket for a few weeks, and all of a sudden it's more football, more football, more football, and more football. And fifth Test match is still underway at the Oval, and we're into the European qualifying championships for some league we can't explain, and the Premier season's and everything's up and running. So, yeah, it's football 12 months a year now, I think.
Lithuania took on Serbia last night. Serbia 1-0 winners in that one. No goals in the Romania-Montenegro group. These were the played in Group C4 of the UEFA Nations League. Azerbaijan against Kosovo was 0-0. Faroe Islands took on Malta and beat Malta as well. So I suppose there is an example of where the lower ranked teams of the 55 UEFA teams get the opportunity to play against more competitive competition, as opposed to being rolled over a bit by the big teams.
Yeah, we always see those European qualifying or World Cup qualifying groups in Europe with some pretty minnow teams, Tom, whether it be San Marino or Gibraltar or the Faroe Islands. They're always there or thereabouts. So I guess it's going to give them some more meaningful fixtures against more teams. So that's a good thing for those smaller teams. It's, again, if you're one of the Premiership clubs and Cristiano Ronaldo is going off to play against the Faroe Islands in a match that means something, you're going to probably sigh and wonder where your investment's gone there. Where Paul Pogba's are off playing for France against San Marino, you've probably got to have some issues with that. But there we go. That's the way it is. UEFA are cashing in on it somehow, I'm sure. So just more and more football. The thing is, when you get so much of it, it's hard to get excited about it, for me anyway.
Italy took on Poland last night as well, 1-1 in that one. Turkey were beaten by Russia over in Turkey. And I suppose there is a good result for the Russians. They went into the World Cup with not much expectations. You were over there watching the final as well. Do you think the performances of Russia at their home World Cup will have acted as a fillip for football in the country?
Yeah, you'd hope so. They went into the World Cup, I think they were almost the least favourite team to actually do well, and they qualified and they went into the knockout phases there, and they did quite well. So, yeah, let's hope it does provide a boost for the likes of Russia, such a big country, and you'd think they could be better with their population and the size of some of those stadiums now. Maybe the legacy of a World Cup is that they'll kick on to the next level. So let's wait and see. It'll be interesting to see how some of these teams back up, who did well at the World Cup, back up now. Some teams have question marks, like Germany, they need to probably perform well. And then the likes of France, who did so well winning it, how will they back up? Is this with the pressure off? Can they get motivated again to play in this competition after being, named, World Cup champions for the second time in their history? So I think all the teams will have plenty to play for. I think Cristiano Ronaldo sort of said, I like the weekend off, so he's not fronting up for Portugal. And then you've got the likes of Croatia with Luka Modric and all their stars actually playing in these matches, backing up as well. So it's a tough season for some of those players. They haven't literally had any time off at all. Maybe 2 weeks. Have you made the back end of a World Cup and made the semi-finals or final? Even some of the England boys, the Harry Kanes and the Dele Allies, who played a lot of matches, 2 weeks off. Premier League started. They're off on international duty again, more travel. It's a tough time for a footballer. They get compensated pretty well, but extremely tough on the schedules.
I feel so sorry for Harry Kane. £150,000 a week, must be tough.
Scotland were in action last night, although they probably won't want me to remind them. They weren't playing in this particular tournament. They were playing an international friendly against Belgium, another team who went deep into the World Cup. And it was Belgium who were on fire. Goals from Lukaku, Hazard and Batshuayi, all the Premier League boys, seeing Belgium beat Scotland by 4-0. That won't come as good news to our friend Chris McCarty, will it?
Not at all, not at all. And as you say, the Scots have got a lot to do, Tom, on the football side of things.
There was also wins as well for Brazil. They got into action yesterday in another international friendly. Sorry, that was earlier on today, in fact, early hours of this morning. They were taking on the United States over in the US. Goals for Roberto Firmino and Neymar, seeing the Brazilians seal that one. Also saw Richarlison, who's had such a great start to the season in the Premier League after his move from Watford up to Everton, starting for Brazil for his very first cap as well. And you just look at that team, you know, Neymar, Firmino, Richarlison coming into it now as well. Just peppered with world-class players. It's a surprise they didn't go deeper into the tournament.
Well, you got the likes of Philippe Coutinho in there as well. And yeah, I mean, they're man for man, as talented as anyone in the competition. It's just the problem with Brazil, I always feel, Tom, is their players are scattered so far around the world that they're never actually back in Brazil probably playing together as much as they should. They get assembled, you know, from all over the place, and it must be quite tough for them to actually gel in such a short space of time, playing in all different leagues, in all different styles, albeit with some of the leading clubs in the world, don't get me wrong. But when they come together in the national way to try and find a style, it might be quite difficult at short notice to really get them going and playing as a team, despite having all those talented individuals.
Look at this. I've got the starting lineup that ran out over there in the States. Alisson in goal, of course. Fabinho, Marquinhos, Thiago Silva, Felipe Luis, Fred, Casemiro, Coutinho, Douglas Costa, Roberto Firmino and Neymar. And then got the likes of Sousa Suarez, Richarlison, Willian and Vital da Silva all coming off the bench at key stages of the game. So strength in depth there. The UEFA Nations Cup is back in action. We will have Northern Ireland in action for you, I guess, Bosnia, in just a few moments' time. That one kicks off in 15, so any goals in that. In the final hour of the show, we will have them for you. Text us now, 4001, if you'd like to have your say.
This is The Grill. Get involved with the show. Text 4001 or message us for free on the Dubai Eye Messenger app.
Players just coming back out onto the field for the afternoon session of the fifth and final test match. England against India. It's down at the Kia Oval. Is it still the Kia Oval? It must be still the Kia Oval.
Well be. I know it's the Oval.
It's the Oval to us, isn't it?
Exactly.
Lovely ground. I love the Oval. I think it's a great ground. Good to see Sir Mick Jagger there yesterday, or just Mick Jagger. He was one of a packed out crowd to see Alistair Cook in his final test match. I don't know how many of the England fans would expect to see England coming back out to the field to bat, that is, after lunch.
Yeah, England have went and had their cups of tea and their cucumber sandwiches, and they're back out at action. It's an unbroken partnership of 97 runs between Jos Buttler, 68 not out, and Stuart Broad chipping in with the bat for a first time in a while, 38 not out. So England now 311 for 8. India would have wanted to knock them over quickly this morning and get out there in the middle and make the most of these good batting conditions. But England 311 for 8 back just after lunch now. And India still got a good chance here if they can knock England over and get out to start their first innings. But England 311 for 8, they've done well. Butler 68 not out, Broad 38 not out.
Let's go to the world of golf now. And it seems that every time you mention the word golf roundabout now, there are two words that follow it up. Ryder Cup is just a couple of weeks away.
Back in May 2011, the bidding process to host the 2018 Ryder Cup reached its conclusion at the European Tour's headquarters. Germany, Spain, Portugal and Holland were all contenders, but it was the lure of Paris that won over the judging panel.
Boasting the oldest national open, stage every year outside the war years since 1906, and with outstanding commitment throughout the country, it goes to France.
It has been an amazing process, but it has been also a very long journey because we have started the process in 2008. At this time, the French Golf Federation wanted to bid to host the Ryder Cup because we thought that it was important to host such an event to help the development of the game. So the process has really started in 2008. The bidding process lasts during 3 years. And we won the bid the 17th of May 2011. And after that, to win a bid, you have to do many promises. And since 2011, I have now to deliver all the promises that we did to win the bid.
This will be the second Ryder Cup played in continental Europe. The first was in Spain in 1997. The charms of Paris have been pivotal in the build-up, and that will continue when both teams arrive in September.
It's great for France to host the Ryder Cup, but it's also great for the Ryder Cup brand to be played close to a main city like Paris. So it will not only be a French touch here on the course, but it will be the French touch around the organization of the Ryder Cup. For example, we will have this fan zone in the center of Paris. It's quite unique because the last venue, you couldn't imagine that the Ryder Cup was played, for example, in the center of Minneapolis. You had nothing in the center of Minneapolis. In Gleneagles, it was also difficult. In Edinburgh, you had not a fan zone as the one that we will create here in the center of Paris. Hosting the gala dinner at the Chateau de Versailles, you know, it's, I think, a special French touch. And what we did for the year to go when the two captains has played from the first floor of the Eiffel Tower, this is the kind of things which represents the French touch.
The recent Open de France on the Rolex series showed what a great venue Le Golf National is. Tickets for this Ryder Cup sold out within the first 2 hours of being on sale, with a record number of fans expected to attend.
I think that first, this course has been built in the past. It was a flat area. It was a piece of land for agriculture. And in 1990, when the French Golf Federation has decided to build a golf course, we had this idea of building these artificial buttes. And from these artificial buttes, you have a perfect view on the game. And I think that that's the reason why we will be able to host much more spectators than in the other venues. You have no trees, so it's not like, for example, in certain venues, they had, unfortunately, to cut trees. Here, we don't have this problem. So from the buttes, the spectators will be in total comfort and will have a perfect view to follow the games and the players.
Keeping the fans happy is a huge part of staging the event, as are the environmental considerations.
We did many surveys. For example, we did an inventory of all the flowers and all the animals before the Ryder Cup, and we will do it after the Ryder Cup. And we have guarantee that we will replace everything and everything will be exactly like it was before the Ryder Cup. We did that work also concerning irrigation. We have now a new irrigation system, and this irrigation system will consume less water than in the past, and it will allow us to save water, which is very important today.
The French Golf Federation is determined to ensure this Ryder Cup adds to the event's heritage, made possible by the support of a key sponsor who understands the need for excellence.
First of all, Rolex is the partner, an historical partner of the French Golf Federation, historical partner of the Ryder Cup, and historical partner of the French Open. So we know each other since many years, and we know at the French Golf Federation the huge support that Rolex has brought to help us in all our different projects. And for example, when the French Golf Federation has decided to bid, the first partner in the Club des Partenaires was Rolex France, thanks to Mr. Schaeffer, who took this decision to support the French bid.
The hope is that France hosting this Ryder Cup will boost the popularity of golf in the country, with a view to increasing participation in the sport, particularly with young people.
Maybe we have other sports like football. And when you have a kid, he plays naturally football and he doesn't play naturally golf. And unfortunately, golf had still an elitist image, but really things are changing. We are the only federation in continental Europe to grow the number of kids at the French Golf Federation, and this since 2009. So I think that the Ryder Cup will help us to develop the game and to change also the image, this elitist image that unfortunately the golf still have.
European captain Thomas Bjorn has named his vice-captains and the final list of players will be confirmed in September. Hopes are high in France that one of their own homegrown golfers will be part of the 12-man team.
We know that we have very lot of expectations. For example, it will be the first time where a Ryder Cup in Europe will host so many Americans. Why? Because it's Paris. So we think that with all what we have put in place, the Ryder Cup will be a success. If we have a French, it will be a special flavor in extra. But if we don't have a French, it will be for sure. The Ryder Cup will allow us and help us to develop the game. If we have a French, it will be better. If not, unfortunately, we will develop the game and the golf will have this, the image will be totally different after the Ryder Cup.
Running from September the 28th to the 30th, this Ryder Cup is set to be a unique edition of golf's premier team event.
It's the end of the month. It is the Ryder Cup and obviously all the big guns, players trying to get as much preparation in at the moment. So let's take a look at the leaderboard, shall we? We've got a couple of significant tournaments taking place both sides of the channel. Let's start in the United States. Which is the tournament taking place over there?
It's the BMW Championship. It's the penultimate event of the FedEx Series. It's a very lucrative series, Tom. You walk away with millions of dollars if you can survive to the end, and the Tour Championship is next weekend. I'll give you the round three leaderboard. They're beginning underway in Philadelphia in the next couple of hours. It's round three leaderboard is first position, 13 under par, is the American Xander Schauffele, who was one of the youngsters who did pretty well during the Open Championship. He has had rounds of 63 and 64. Two shots back from Schauffele is Justin Rose, the Englishman, 11 under par, rounds of 66 and 63. And then the leaderboard does really sort of bunch up a lot. Tied for third at 10 under par, one shot back from Rose. Keegan Bradley, Alex Noren, Ricky Fowler and Hideki Matsuyama at 10 under par. Tied for seventh, five players at 9 under par. Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas, Jason Day, Billy Horschel and Charles Howell the third. Notable others, Tiger Woods has found great form in the last couple of weeks. He's been in contention, it seems like, for a while now. 8 under par. Tommy Fleetwood, who's also been pretty consistent, 7 under par. And a couple of those Ryder Cup names we'll be talking about in the next couple of weeks. John Rahm, 5 under par, and Henrik Stenson, 5 under par. So good to see Henrik Stenson putting some injury issues behind him. But yeah, only a couple of weeks away from the Ryder Cup at Le Golf National in Paris. The top players in the world are really honing their game at the moment, Tom. So Xander Schauffele, 13 under par, two-shot lead from the Englishman, Justin Rose. Rose will play a key role for Team Europe, for Thomas Bjorn in the Ryder Cup.
That's the BMW Championship over in Philadelphia. What's happening in Switzerland? We've got the Amiga European Masters.
That's correct, Tom. And what I can tell you, it's Englishman Matt Fitzpatrick shot a fantastic 5 under today, 64 round for him. That takes him to 3 shots ahead of Gavin Green on the leaderboard at 12 under par. Gavin Green, he's tied second with Daniel Brooks and Day W. Usham at 9 under par. And then we've got Lee Westwood, who is coming to some form of late. Of course, he was in that playoff last week in Denmark. He's sitting at 7 under par.
We're going to talk wild cards with our wild boys here in just a few minutes' time. So if you'd like to contribute your thoughts to both the US and the European Ryder Cup teams, we encourage you to do exactly that. Text us now on 4001.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.